birthplace of radio's greatest era. Live from New York, it's Radio Night Live with Kevin McCullough.
Wait, who?
Kevin McCullough, let me start with you.
Huh? The big dog, Kevin McCullough.
Who? Kevin McCullough.
No.
Nationally syndicated radio host and author of No He Can't.
Who? Kevin McCullough?
Kevin McCullough is a nationally syndicated radio host and author of No He Can't.
What?
A Barack Obama's dismantling hope and change and CEO of Extreme Media.
Oh.
All right. Welcome to Saturday night. Glad to have you with us, Kevin McCullough, on a Saturday in which we've got a lot of important things to discuss tonight. And I am really excited about the people that are here to do just that. Joey Knuckles going to knock someone off tonight. No. That's Pastor Greg Laurie of Harvest Christian Fellowship in Southern California. He has actually written a really powerful brand new book on the life of Billy Graham, Dr. Billy Graham, the Billy Graham, but not just any Billy Graham. It's the Billy Graham that he knows as a person, someone who worked with Dr. Graham and so forth. And it's called The Man I Knew. And this is his third major biography in just because it's a pastor talking about Billy Graham. This is going to be interesting stuff. You stick around. You wait. You see. Then in the middle there, that's Riley Clemens. That's tonight's music artist. She did really, really well at the K-Love Music Awards just a couple of weeks ago, and she's got a couple of performances for us tonight that are going to blow your socks off. And then to the far right of your screen right there, in the ladies' lounge tonight, a mom and a daughter, Cynthia and Margaret Monteleone, that have both, and this is one of those things you just live through once, you go, I've never seen anything like that before. They have both had to race in the track and field event of the 400 meters against trans athletes that were biologically male. And Cynthia, a longtime world champion in the 400 meter, is speaking out about that. Because as not only she had to race against someone who was biologically male, her daughter did only a short time later, and it has really impacted them. And this is something that when we're talking about, you know, where we are in life right now with all of the problems that the world faces, the idea that we are going to completely upend what is scientific and normal for that which is utterly preposterous is a place where I think once we round the corner, there's no return from there. You're in full grade Looneyville at that point. And it's not just the Monteleones that are dealing with this. We told you about the story of the girls from Connecticut last year that ran track. Actually, Kelsey Bowler from the Daily Signal and from the Independent Women's Forum has interviewed both of the Connecticut girls and the Monteleones, and she was the one that got us connected so that we could have tonight's discussion. And I look forward to them joining us from Maui tonight. It should be they are Hawaiian, and it should be very good to have that conversation in hour number two in the ladies' lounge. And of course, as I already said, music by a person that is running for a seat in Congress to oust a Republican who voted in favor of his impeachment. And if I am looking at Instagram properly, the crowds for President Trump have never been bigger. He's still packing them in enormous numbers. And this has to weigh on people's minds, not just the people that may run for president in 2024, but for the very timid and very topsy-turvy administration that's in power right now. I just don't know how, and I was listening to a little bit of what President Trump said before we came on the air. You listen to the checklist of things that he accomplished and things that he turned around, and what they are doing to undo that, not because it's the right thing to do, just because they don't want him to have the ability to say that he accomplished that anymore. That's really how petty and severely unimportant this current presidency is. And let me give you an example, because this news is just crossing the wires tonight. Earlier today, or late yesterday, I guess I should say, President Biden mandated workplace race-based diversity programs in all federal agencies. Now, you may remember that in September of 2020, the president had undone, he had put a halt to all critical race theory training in across the government. In fact, he had banned it from being allowed to go forward. One of President Biden's first acts in January was to undo that ban. So then it became kind of a neutral thing. If the department wanted to do it, they could. Now he is forcing it to occur in every agency across the government. And this is what the White House is saying as of last night. These types of trainings supposedly equip public servants to best serve the American public and the many diverse communities that make America strong. Biden's order came 3 days after Vice President Kamala Harris broke a party-line Senate deadlock to confirm Kiran Ahuja, who has ties to critical race theory, as the director of the Federal Office of Personnel Management, overcoming Republican efforts to sink the nomination. Ahuja's connection to the subject comes via her nonprofit organization, Philanthropy Northwest, which hosted CRT activist Ibrahim X. Kendi in an event earlier this year. Okay, so why is this a big deal? Well, obviously this debate, critical race theory, is going on. It's going on in almost every community across the country. There are school board meetings that are devolving into absolute pandemonium in places in Virginia and other places where this debate has raged thoroughly. But what are they really discussing? Well, if you'd been listening to this show only a couple of weeks ago, you would have heard Voddie Baucham, who wrote the book Fault Lines, kind of lay it out for us. Critical race theory is nothing more than a reverse form of racism that is designed by necessity to make all white people feel as though they are guilty of something that most, if not all of them, have never had any association with, and very few had anything have any way of this idea that every person survive on their own merit, and that actually what you should do is you should punish white people, that there should be reparations paid by white people for just being born white, that there's nothing more that you need to be guilty of than that in order for you to be guilty of racism. It fundamentally believes and asserts the belief that America is a fundamentally racist country, and only in certain pockets are there anti-racist Americans. The truth, and history can show this, by the way, you can go back through our history and you can demonstrate this actively. America is systemically an anti-racist country, and there may be some survival of racist pockets in different places, but we fight against those. Americans of all political stripes fight against those. Americans that support the former President Donald Trump and Americans that support the current President Joe Biden all believe that racism is evil and it's something that should be warred against. That's not what critical race theory teaches. Critical race theory teaches that because you are a person with white skin, you are systemically a racist person and you have no say in the matter. It's built on Marxism. It's built off of Marx's theory of conflict the idea that you've got to have a revolution underway in order to achieve the most radical equitable fairness for all. America firmly rejects that. But this is what Joe Biden is now force feeding. It's not just that he undid President Trump's ban on this. It's that he is now shoving it down the throats of every government agency, coast to coast, in every government office that the federal government is responsible for. And just to pause on that for a second, it is interesting that the state that has embraced this the most, California, is embracing reparations to be paid in the form of housing credits for people in their state. And I need to point out two things. California never legalized slavery. And to some degree, they never really had any issue of slavery involved in their state's history or massive, systemic systems set up to keep slaves down and people from being free. It's one of the most absurd states. It's one of the most absurd places to insist upon this, and is one of the most absurd things that can be insisted.
Whether it's a sunny staycation or a summer vacation,
751, or by going to balanceofnature.com and make sure to receive this special radio offer by using discount code KMC.
Of all the boys, of all the boys, boys. Of all the boys, 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 of all the boys.
All right, Kevin McCullough, glad to have you with us. You know, every day what we try to do is we try to dissect what is on the front page of the paper and give you some context about what it means and then why it matters to you living your life in this day and age. If you're a person of faith, if you are someone who is searching out an interest in faith, if you are someone who has rejected faith, that's what we try to provide for you on a daily basis. And every now and then I have the chance to kind of set the front page section of the paper down and go a little bit deeper into some of the personalities and some of the stories behind some of the, I don't know, the most important figures in history or the biggest concepts of life, some of the big debates of the day. And I've always been very honored to have this next guest join us whenever he's capable of doing so. It is not often because he is very busy as a senior pastor and is also someone who has kind of picked up the mantle of evangelism crusades in a way that has not been done really in regular frequency in recent years. But it was kind of pioneered by the person who is the subject of his most recent book. Now, if you've been with us in the last few years, you've heard us talk about Steve McQueen some of his exploits. But Pastor Greg Laurie has always approached his writing about some of these characters from a very specific angle. And he's done the same here with his new biography, Billy Graham, The Man I Knew. And Pastor Greg, you don't get out to New York very often, but we always appreciate it when you do. But I'm so grateful that you've made time for us today. Kevin McCullough Radio, thanks for being back.
Kevin, thanks for having me. I miss New York. It's been quite a while since I visited, and I just love that city, and I've been going there pretty much my entire life. But thanks for having me in to talk about this book about Billy Graham, who, you know, he was an iconic figure. I think that people, you know, most people have heard the name Billy Graham. As an example, he was on the list of the most admired men more than any other man in American history. And he just kind of went on from generation to generation of people that appreciated him. But now there's a whole new generation that have heard the name maybe, but they don't really understand this was a flesh and blood guy. This was a guy who was a risk taker, an innovator. He was the king of all media before Howard Stern claimed to be. He was a man who had a lot of energy, and he was a man who I would say quite literally changed the world.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. And I'm curious, Greg, and by the way, those of you joining us, you may recognize that voice. Greg Laurie, of course, heard every weekday morning here on AM 570 and FM 102.3, the Mission WMCA. Greg, I was thinking back, and this was more around the time of his death, a couple of years ago, but I was trying to remember, like, the first time I had heard the name Billy Graham or maybe had seen a picture of him. And for me, it was pretty simple. I'm only 51, so the first time that I heard a aid service that they would put on air anywhere she could find. She needed to make a decision about who Jesus was, and if they were taking Billy Graham at his word, then they would embrace that he was God's son and go down that path. I'm curious for you, what was your first memory, your earliest memory of Billy Graham?
Well, it's a parallel memory to yours, Kevin. I first saw Billy Graham watching television on my grand old kid, but then after I became a Christian at the age of 17, I went to hear him in person in San Diego, and then I fully understood what Billy Graham did and what he was about. And, you know, he once did an interview with David Frost, a British interviewer, and Billy told David that he studied to be simple. I think people may find it surprising to know more effort goes into making a message simple than making it complex. Billy was not simplistic, but he was simple. He understood that when he stepped into the pulpit, his job was clear. He was to preach for a decision. The difference between evangelistic preaching, which Billy did and which I do as well, and Bible exposition is, you know, the expositor is unleashing the text. They're telling you what the text says, present who Jesus is, the claims that Jesus made, tell you how to come into a relationship with Christ, and then invite you to do it. So that was a very distinct calling on Billy's life. I once asked Billy, about this, and he said, I don't think I'm a great preacher, but I think God has given me the gift to give the invitation. And it's one of the few times I disagreed with Billy. I said, well, I don't agree with you. I think you're actually a great preacher. And his response would always be, well, I'm just a country preacher. And the fact is, you know, he was raised on a dairy farm right. in Charlotte, North Carolina. He never aspired to be a world, you know, a renowned figure known around the globe. But maybe that's one of the reasons God plucked him from obscurity and used him, because this is not what he wanted to be. He wanted to be a baseball player like a lot of young boys.
Of course.
But the Lord had a unique plan for Billy's life. But I think that simplicity was a discipline, and it was one of the secrets of his success.
I think so. We're speaking with Pastor Greg Laurie, and you know him from Harvest Christian Fellowship in Southern California, and of course his radio broadcast heard on so many stations across the country each day. But he is the author of Billy Graham, The Man I Knew, the next kind of installment in Greg Laurie's kind of series of books. You're kind of into this biography thing now. A lot of pastors take their sermon series and put a cover on it and call it a book. You're actually going out and digging into some of these lives. Just comment on that for me for a second about, you know,
yeah. Well,
why.
It started with Steve McQueen. You know, I'd heard the story that McQueen had become a Christian. So just out of sheer curiosity and my search engine, I typed in Steve McQueen, come Leonard, and I interviewed him, and I got really interested in the story, and I said, I've got to tell this story. And so my friend John Irwin, who's a filmmaker who directed I Can Only Imagine,
right.
I called.
Drivers who fix their own cars just got a smarter tool.
And find out how to put precious metals in your hands, tax deductible. Their process is easy. Call the Landmark team at 844-604-2575. That's 844-604-2575 or landmarkcapital.com. All right, welcome back. It's Radio Night Live. Kevin McCullough, what a beautiful shot of Lord. Manhattan, so grateful to men, basically. And why are they speaking up and speaking out about it? We'll get to that. But we are in the midst of a discussion with Greg Laurie, Billy Graham, the man I knew. And before we went to the break, Greg, you were telling us about your path into biography. You've written biographies for Steve McQueen, Johnny Cash, and now Billy Graham. What took you down that road?
Well, the fact is, Billy Graham was the glue between Cash and McQueen.
Wow.
When McQueen found out he had cancer toward the end of his life, he wanted to meet Billy Graham because McQueen was already a Christian at this point. And so Steve was on his way to a clinic in Juarez, Mexico, and Billy met with McQueen on his jet, on Billy or on, McQueen's jet that he had chartered for the flight. And that's all, but unfortunately and tragically, he died in recovery. And they went into that room and pulled the sheet back, and he was hanging on to that Bible Billy Graham gave him. Hmm. So, and also, you know, Billy was a very good friend of Johnny Cash. They worked together a lot. They vacationed together. They fished together. Their wives were friends. And so, I just thought, wow, Badon, and being an advisor and being a very good listener. And this is another one of Billy's secrets, in addition to his simplicity, was his ability to build bridges to unexpected people and minister to them. But but the amazing thing is he didn't brag about it. You know, sometimes you have so-called celebrity preachers who maybe have, you know, famous people come and visit them. So we see lots of, you know, selfies with them. And, you know, Billy never did things like that. Billy never talked about these people. Billy just ministered to them and tried to actually move them toward Christ.
That's such an encouragement and so typical of what I've been told about Dr. Graham all these years. We're speaking with Greg Laurie, whose new book, Billy Graham, The Man I Knew, is a biography, but it's told from the perspective that is a little bit kind of insightful from his own personal perspective. And Greg, we can touch on that. You spent some time towards the end of his career helping him in some very important ways. But let's talk about the younger Billy Graham that people don't know. And I do have this question. Is there another link between Johnny Cash, Steve McQueen, Billy Graham, and Greg Laurie that includes motorcycles? Because it seems like, if memory serves me correctly, I don't know if Billy Graham did, but I think everybody else has a love for the motorbike in that group.
There's some truth to that. You know, here's the funny thing. Billy, to my knowledge, never rode a motorcycle. He may have, but his wife Ruth did.
And Franklin certainly did.
He rode a Harley down the road and actually dumped it. But that was Ruth. She was a real risk taker, and I talk a lot about her in this book. And just as an aside, there would never have been Billy Graham as we know him without Ruth Graham. She was in every way his equal. She was an amazing McQueen was huge into motorcycles, motocross, Harleys, Indians. He rode everything you could ride, plus cars, race cars. You know, of course, we all know him for his movies like Bullet and, you know, his 67 Mustang, etc. I don't know about Cash riding motorcycles. So that one I can't recall anything there. But, you know, I think the link in these guys is you know, they came from nowhere to where they were. In other words, none of them was a son of a famous person. Steve was abandoned basically by his father. He never met his biological father. His mother was living a crazy alcoholic lifestyle. He was spent time being raised by his grandparents. And so he came from nowhere to become at one point the number one movie star in the world. Johnny Cash, he literally was out on the fields picking cotton, living in what I would describe as poverty. And, you know, he just realized he had this ability to sing. And one thing led to another, and he went on to become an iconic figure, beloved by generations, old and young alike. And then Billy, as I mentioned, a dairy farmer. You know, and he was somebody who he had a lot of energy in his childhood. Today they would probably describe him as hyperactive, but all that energy just needed to be channeled in the right.
With Script, you're never far from endless entertainment.
And 35% off on any new preferred order of fruits and veggies. Start your journey to better health today by calling 1-800-246-8751 or by going to balanceofnature.com and use discount code KMC.
Glad to have you with us on this Saturday night. Kevin McCullough live from New York, Radio Night Live. That's a live shot of a very busy Times Square, and you can tell the masks are off and life is starting to return to normal. Anyway, welcome. Glad to have you with us. Greg Laurie's book is called Billy Graham, The Man I Knew, and it is a personal telling of his relationship with the famous evangelist and longtime preacher, man who interacted with many, many presidents. And we are, Greg, as we were going to break, I was reminded of this one part of Billy Graham's story, which had to do with the famous L.A. crusade, a crusade that they really at one point thought they were just going to have to fold up and leave because there really wasn't much happening and they were looking for some sort of sign to try to say, right?
There was a radio personality named Stuart Hamblin. Everybody knew him. He was like this cowboy singer, colorful guy who was known for his hard drinking and his antics and trouble he got into. And he actually accepted Christ at the last night of Billy's preaching there at the tent and talked about it in his radio show. So all kinds of press show up. At the same time, William Randolph Hearst, who owned many magazines and newspapers, was really impressed by Graham. And so he sent out a two-word telegram to all of his people, which simply said, Puff Graham. So literally overnight, the press showed up in swarms, and Billy became an international news story, and then they continued the crusade, and history was made. He went to a Madison Square Garden, held a series of crusades. There's a book about it called God in the Garden. One night, and he had Martin Luther King get up and pray, which was very controversial in the day. But Billy forged a relationship with King,
right,
who he called Mike. And Dr. King came and prayed, and that became a history-making crusade. Thousands of people gathered in Times Square to hear Billy preach. I thought, wow, wouldn't that be amazing to do something like that today? You can see archival photos of it. And the final crusade that Billy did was in Flushing Meadows,
yep,
where the World's Fair was held, and I attended that one.
We actually broadcast from there. This radio, yep, station actually broadcast from there for that for the duration of that. And
yeah,
and you know, it's funny, Greg. Such a small world. Sean Hannity, my competition on the other state, he was on ABC at the time, and I ended up sitting almost next to each other at the Flushing Queens Crusade, and our wives were yeah, there, but side by side, and it just speaks to the kind of universality of the truth of,
yeah,
of what Graham had to share. It was simple. It wasn't complicated. It was Jesus. It was,
yeah,
hope, salvation, and it was for the celebrity. It was for the person that nobody knew, and it was for everybody in between.
Well, speaking of Sean Hannity, yes, I saw him there. I believe he interviewed Billy, and also, remember Hannity and Combs? What was Combs' first name?
Alan Combs.
Yeah, Alan Combs. So he was there, too. Now, here's what's interesting. Sean interviewed Billy, but I went to a tent in the back, and there sat Sean Combs watching Billy on the TV set, watched his entire sermon from beginning to end.
Yeah.
And so here we have the conservative guy and the liberal guy.
That's right. That's
being
right,
reached by Billy. And guess who else showed up to that crusade? Bill and Hillary Clinton were there as well.
I had forgotten about
that.
Yeah,
of the kind of bridges that Billy built.
Well, and that and speak to that for a second, because he had a personal relationship with, I believe, every president from, what was it, Eisenhower forward, and
Truman. Yeah.
Obama was kind of, you know, a little less in terms of the personal because his health was starting to diminish in the later
but
stages.
He met Obama.
Yeah, but they, but and, yeah, so and he, Billy, I think he prayed with all of them.
Yes, absolutely. So Billy, his first president he was involved with was Harry Truman.
Okay.
And he kind of misfired on that one by his own admission. He went to the White House. Billy was, you know, already very popular at that point. He met with the president. He made the mistake of, in protocol, of putting his hand on the president's shoulder and praying for him. And that was not supposed to be done. And then afterwards, he went with the two fellows that joined him. And the press asked him questions. He talked about what they discussed in the Oval Office. And then the press asked if he would, all of them would get down on their knees in front of the White House. And they recorded that. They filmed it. I took a picture of it. And Truman was not happy. Billy later met up with Truman and apologized for that. He was young. He was, you know, figuring these things out. Hmm. He was very close to Eisenhower. And he knew every president. And some, he was closer to some presidents than with others. He was very close with LBJ. He was fairly close with Kennedy. In fact, he told me once, I asked Billy if he had any regrets, and he said, yes, he regretted one thing. He was speaking at a presidential prayer breakfast, and afterwards, President Kennedy said, Billy, I would like you to drive with me back to the White House. There's something I want to talk to you about. And Billy said, well, Mr. President, I have the flu, and I don't want you to catch it. How about if I come back in a week or so when I'm feeling better, and I'll visit with you? And President Kennedy said, okay. And then only days after that, Kennedy flew to Dallas, Texas.
Oh, no.
Assassinated. Oh. Billy said, I always wondered what he wanted to talk to me about, and I regret that. But he was close to Johnson, preached at President Johnson's funeral. Of course, he was close to President Nixon, and was horrified to hear see a different side of the president that he had never seen. Privately, he was very close to Ronald Reagan, very close to George H.W. and George W. Bush. In fact, George W. Bush said that Billy played a key role in his conversion. And then fast-forwarding to President Obama, Billy was very old at this point and spent even had a relationship with Trump, because I was at Billy's 95th birthday party and businessman Donald Trump was there sitting at Billy's table. So he wasn't president yet, but he knew and admired Graham as well.
That is an amazing story. And Greg, Laurie, thank you for your time tonight. Always appreciate it when you can make time to chat with me about these things. The book is called The Man I Knew. It is authored by Greg Laurie, who you may know as a prominent pastor from Southern California, but he is becoming a celebrated biographer, having written the biographies of Steve McQueen and Johnny Cash and now Billy Graham, and actually three personalities that ended up having some connection to each other. But very, very interesting.
See yourself.
Welcome back.
A free analysis called Your Financial Blueprint, and find out how to put precious metals in your hands tax deductible. Their process is easy. Call the Landmark team at 844-604-2575. That's 844-604-2575 or landmarkcapital.com. Ladies and gentlemen, she is a rising star on the CCM scene. She had a huge awards night just not long ago, like the K-Love Awards. Here is Riley Clemens.
Like a song I've heard one too many times, like the same old movie. You're always gonna make me cry. Just pain and trouble with a good disguise. Trying to start a fight, trying to steal my light. All you ever did was hold me back, so now I'm never ever coming back. But why? Tell me why. You're stuck inside my head. Can I just get cash or won't you rip my head? I would rather take on anything instead. I try to fight it, but it's you. It's always you. You're stuck. But it's reminding me, all you ever did was hold me back. So now I'm never ever coming back. But why? Tell me why. You're stuck inside my head. And I just can't get you out your head. I'd rather think of anything instead. I try to fight it, but it's you. It's always you. You're stuck inside my head. Stuck inside my head. Maybe it'll just take time for me to leave the past behind, but I'ma get you off up. That I've got better things to think about than all the ways you dragged me down. But right here in this moment, all I know is that I got in the way. You're stuck inside my head, and I just can't get you out your
Kevin McCullough.
And Kevin McCullough.
No.
Nationally syndicated.
All right, welcome to Saturday night. Kevin McCullough, so glad to have you with us. And as you know, in hour number two, we like to turn to the Ladies Lounge, where we every single week we're going to deliberately carve out time to capture some of the perspective of the ladies in our lives, those that are contributing to all kinds of things across the societal and cultural spectrum in our world today. And I am honored to have my guest tonight. I've never had a world champion track athlete grace the Ladies Lounge, and tonight to have Cynthia Monteleone join us is very, very exciting. And she is joining us from the, I don't know what the time difference is, but I know it's a lot of hours difference between here and there.
6 hours. So still bright and shiny morning for us.
Yeah. Well, I remember years ago when my bride and I got married. We got married in Southern California, and then we honeymooned in Hawaii, in Maui, actually. And I thought, you know, this is pretty easy. I'm from the other coast. We'll get on a plane. Just a couple hours, we'll be there. You guys are as far away from California as New York is.
That's correct, yeah. It's still a five-hour flight from California.
So. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Hey, for people that are not familiar, recap for us a little bit of your track career. How did you make your name and come up through the ranks?
Sure. Well, I was a Division I athlete. I ran track on scholarship at University of North Carolina Wilmington, which was a Division I school. I finished top five in the East Coast, but was not really in the Olympic caliber at that time. So went on to have my career and three kids. And when I turned 40, my daughter, who was then 11, said to me, Mom, I want to run track in college like you did on scholarship. And will you train me? I want to run the 400 meters just like you did. Now, I had not run in over 20 years, like not at all. Maybe a couple of times jogging with friends, but like that was it. And so we got out on the track, ran a 400 meter time trial pretty slowly, crawled over the finish line because it was the most brutal 400 I've ever run in my life, and started from there. And you know what? We just kept showing up and making sacrifices in our time and worked really hard in our training, showed up 3 times a week for running, 4 times a week for strength training. And after showing up that many times, it took, let's see, about 2 years, 3 years, at age 43, I became a world champion. So I knew after my first track meet, I was at the National Masters Championships, I got a 4th place ribbon. I knew at that point I never wanted a 4th place ribbon again. I vowed to come back and win the national championship the next year, which I did. And then I said, I'm going to be a world champion. And so I just really worked really hard. The 400 meters, if you're not familiar, is one of the hardest races of track because you basically have to sprint the whole lap around the track. So at age 43 in my world championship gold, I ran faster than I did in college, which is unheard of. That's not supposed to be happening. And along the course of my journey, I had met my mentor, which was Charles Poliquin. He was strength coach to a lot of Olympians, and I got certified in his program to learn about all like basically the tips and tricks. So I'm a metabolic practitioner. I tell people what to eat and what supplements to take and that sort of thing to be their optimal health and for optimal performance. And my clients are Olympians, professional athletes, but also patients that my doctor sends me when he can't figure out what's wrong with them. Usually autoimmune issues. I love that.
Best superhero warrior self is a mouthful, but I think it is what all of us go to bed at night dreaming about being, and good for you for being able to help other people to do that. And again, the book is called Fast Over 40. Cynthia Monteleone is the author, and if you want to find her on social media, she's on Instagram with the same handle, Fast Over 40, and you can do that simply enough. Cynthia, the life of an athlete, first of all, let's talk about how is it even possible for 40-year-old bones and muscles to move, operate, and exist in a faster universe, a more adept universe than they do at 18, 19, and 20?
That's a really great question, and it takes a lot of different things. It's not just what you're eating, but that is a big part of it, but it's also knowing your body, having blood work done to know if you're deficient in something. A lot of people don't do that. The doctors will actually tell you like you don't need the blood work or something like that. I've had clients that deter them from getting it, but really check your blood work every year, see what you're deficient in. But it's really also about lifestyle. What are you doing to get better sleep? Like sleep is a big part of it. What are you doing to train your muscles, especially as we age? You know, we really have no business doing things that are going to injure us, like maybe explosive lifts if you're not used to it and you're not trained in that. So I really try to help people start from scratch and, you know, get to be their best self through things like tempo training, which means you can lower the weight on the eccentric, which so if, for instance, if you're squatting, you lower in a 4 count, which recruits more muscle fibers, which actually makes you stronger. So instead of just doing an explosive movement. That's just one example of so many that I share the tips and tricks for others. But one of the main things and that I have found through my experience is being on an animal protein-based diet really helps you get the muscle mass you need as you age, because we lose muscle mass. It's called sarcopenia and dynapenia, the loss of muscle and the loss of the power of the muscle. And so as we age, we lose that. And so how can we keep it going? And you really need the amino acids. We're always foraging for amino acids as we get older. And we also absorb protein less as we get older. So it's really important to have a high protein, good quality amino acid diet.
So is that part of the reason then why, because my bride and I, we just started doing yoga a couple of years ago, and she started at first, and she started loving how her body was responding so much, and she had so much
confidence after doing it. I was like, I think I'm going to give that a try. And I played some basketball in college and, you know, some other stuff when I was younger, but I was older, not in the best shape. And I started seeing some results doing some of the things you just described. But is that need for protein? Is that one of the reasons why I crave like some turkey or some scrambled eggs after I get out of my yoga workout on some mornings?
Yes, absolutely. And it's important to actually listen to that craving, because right after you work out is the best time to intake protein. Your cells are actually open to intaking protein the most optimal at that time. So definitely listen to that. In general, red meat sparks neurotransmitters for energy in the morning. So I'm a big proponent of the meat and nuts breakfast. My kids don't eat cereal. We eat basically protein, usually red meat, nuts and berries for breakfast. And then the poultry type meats are great for later in the day because they spark tryptophan, which helps you wind down, gives you some serotonin, helps you wind down.
That all sounds great. Yeah. If I can have steak for breakfast, come on, how much better does it get?
Well, a lot of people, it's so funny because, you know, sometimes I speak up about controversial issues, and one of those controversial issues is red meat right now, which is crazy. But we're big fans of grass-fed beef because it actually can take carbon out of the atmosphere and by rebuilding the soil. So a lot of people think, oh, red meat, bad for the environment. Well, not grass-fed beef. And not only that, it has more omega-3, has more amino acids. So we're really big fans of like our local grass-fed beef company, yeah. Maui Cattle Company. Yeah, and so it's actually proven to be really good for you, red meat. So I eat steak 5 to 7 times a week myself.
Wow.
And my doctor says I've got the best blood work he's ever seen. So red meat can be part of a healthy diet.
That is very encouraging. You're talking to a red meat lover. So we're talking with Cynthia Monteleone, and the book is called Fast Over 40. And you can find her, you can contact her directly on Instagram at Fast Over 40. Follow all the stuff she's got, one of those link tree things. You can link there and see all the stuff she's involved in.
And you know, Kevin, I started a warrior community that encompasses all of the things. Like I said, it's not just what you eat, but it's lifestyle.
Right.
So this month was injury prevention. Last month was champion mentality. So I have a place where people can go and join and be part of a whole community that's learning about all this.
Well, that is good to know. Hang on to that thought. We're coming right back from New York, a very special ladies' lounge tonight, because we're not only going to talk to Cynthia, but also her daughter about one of those controversial things that she speaks up about. It's coming right back from New York, Radio Night Live. Stay with us. Blueprint and find out how to put precious metals in your hands tax deductible. Their process is easy. Call the Landmark team at 844-604-2575. That's 844-604-2575 or landmarkcapital.com.
And now from New York back to Radio Night Live. Here's Kevin McCullough.
All right, Kevin McCullough, Radio Night Live, and yes, your eyes do not deceive you. We have expanded the ladies' lounge. In fact, this may be the first time ever that we've had two ladies in the ladies' lounge at the same time on Saturday nights. But we were speaking with Cynthia Monteleone. If you can't tell them apart, she's the one with the hat. If they just look like sisters, that's because they're so healthy. They just, you know, they exude this youthful exuberance. She's the author of... She's the author of Fast Over 40 and a world-class 400-meter athlete that has experienced something, and I think it's pretty unique, that she and her daughter, Margaret, who now joins us. And Margaret, it's good to welcome you to the show. You've gone through something that I don't know of any other women on planet Earth can say that they've actually experienced, and that is you're both track athletes, and you've both had to compete in women's divisions of sports against biological males. Cynthia, let's start with you. Tell us the story.
Okay, so I competed at the 2018 World Championships in Malaga, Spain, and even though I run the 400, I run the 200 kind of for like a secondary race. And in my 200 meter run was a biological male, and I knew because I had researched my competition beforehand. And when I got there, I started to ask questions as to the fairness of this. to some people and officials and different things. Some track officials were even surprised that they didn't even know that this was the case, that there was this male running in the female division. And others knew, and they told me that maybe for my own safety, I should keep my mouth shut. And I said, no, I won't be silenced. I'm going to keep speaking up about this. And so I spoke up about it over the course of the next couple of years. And turns out that a year and a half later, my daughter lines up for her very first high school race against a biological male. So I think that we are unique in that it's a mother-daughter. We might not even be unique in this, but it's a mother-daughter thing that we both. Both experienced it together. Most mainstream media censors stories like ours. We've reached out to newspapers before. I've had reporters say to me, I really want to tell your story, but I can't, my boss won't let me. You don't know how many times I've heard that. And so they are censoring stories like ours. And so I'm telling you, it's happening way more than you think. It's happening to a lot of women across the country, and opportunities are being taken away from. Daughters.
Yeah, the high school track and field community there lost scholarships and the opportunity. I think they broke 15 state records in a single track season because two boys were running in the girls division. And it was just unbelievable. But Margaret, before I get ahead of myself, tell us about your story. How did that experience shape and inform the way you think about your sport now?
Yeah. My freshman year of high school, I was on the line to run my first ever track meet when I learned that a biological male was going to be competing in my race, which is the 400. And I was extremely nervous. All my teammates were extremely nervous because they knew as well. They were stressed out. One of them even said they didn't want to run track anymore. What was even the point of running track? They were going to be displaced by this obviously physically superior individual. And so I ran my race. They won. They were clearly more capable and stronger as they passed the finish line. They won the heat. I got second. I would have won my first heat at my first track meet my freshman year if this weren't the case. So.
And I've seen the tape. You would have won by a mile. Like, you had really prepared well for that race, but he crushed you by a mile. And you guys all started at the same point, so it's not like someone had an advantage over you.
Right, and she had been training all year and really been working hard, and this individual had only trained for track at all ever for 2 weeks. They had come from volleyball, from playing first in the male volleyball team the year before, and then had transitioned to the female volleyball team just before track season.
And had injured an actual opposing player on an opposing team from a spike that he had hit very, very hard. Friends, as we're talking about this, I'm also reminded of the schools in Southern California that have kind of without question allowed boys that don't make the cut on varsity baseball teams to come out for girls softball. And this, as Cynthia just said, this is going on all across the country at many different levels of competition. And Cynthia, as a mom watching your daughter and knowing what you were able to do in college and kind of having hopes that, you know, I mean, every mom and dad hope that their kid does and excels in whatever they're good at. She obviously has your gift. Does this mean that a scholarship is within reach, or is it somewhat lost because of the way things are currently set up?
Well, what's going to happen, we speak up not just for our story, but we speak up for the generations that are going to come after us. And what will happen is college coaches will be forced to recruit who is competitive. And who is competitive is going to be the trans athletes, the trans girls. So that's who they're going to recruit. And eventually there will be no slots left for our actual biological females. So we really need to get ahead of this, because those opportunities are going to be lost. And now that the courts have ruled that the NCAA has to compensate their athletes, even more is at stake for our daughters and granddaughters and nieces and sisters, all of them, because the whole point of Title IX, which by the way was founded by Patsy Mink, who was from Maui, so it's very important to us here in
sure,
Maui.
Yeah.
Title IX was to provide equal opportunity for women based on their sex. to give them scholarships and things like this as an extension of education. And so now that the current administration has basically put a knife in the heart of Title IX, they've said that now, as of a couple weeks ago or last week, that it now includes these trans athletes. And we really need to speak up and encourage other people to just keep speaking up for what's right and what's fair. And the science tells us that even after hormone therapy and gender reassignment, that male-bodied athletes still hold an advantage over females. But I always say that, you know, common sense always also tells us that. However, there are some scientific studies out there that have proven this. Lundberg is doing great work in this, British Journal of Medicine, I believe. But yeah, you can look up just Lundberg, L-U-N-D-B-E-R-G. But that just backs it up, that what we thought all along was right, that even after hormones and gender reassignment, that they still have an advantage, especially comparably gifted and trained. So, you know, one female athlete may not be, you know, basically, sometimes they might win. Sometimes we might win on some caliber. But if you take the most elite, comparably gifted and trained, the male-bodied athlete will always win.
Well, they certainly have a consistent advantage in terms of bone structure and muscle mass, and
right.
That is what the science. And you know, it's interesting, for all of the jabbering that the left does about following the science and being pro-woman, it doesn't seem like that applies across the board on everything. And so that's all you're asking for, is follow the science and give women the opportunity that they're working so hard to give themselves. You know, they're training and preparing and doing all of this. I want to take a break.
We know what it takes. We are female athletes, so we know what it takes.
Exactly. Well, I got to take another break, but I want you guys to come back for one more segment, because I want to ask Margaret your insights on what you're dealing with.
This is Kate.
Start your journey to better health today by calling 1-800-246-8751 or by going to balanceofnature.com and use discount code KMC.
And now, back to Radio Night Live. Here's Kevin McCullough.
All right, Kevin McCullough, so glad to have you with us. Coming up in the next segment, we're actually going to air the film that has been made about Cynthia and Margaret's story by the Independent Women's Forum, which is that group that I love to death. They're doing great work. Kelsey Bowler, a senior contributor there and someone who's with us often here on Radio Night Live. And again, she made the introductions for us to have Cynthia and Margaret with us tonight. And ladies, I've enjoyed not only hearing your story and kind of the story of your courage and fighting your fight, but also just getting to know you as people. We need more of these common sense, everyday, good, decent types around, and I'm glad to wave the flag for you. Margaret, this your first race, you should have won it by a mile. Someone else stole it from you that was biologically male. How has this changed your opinion of even what you want to do by way of sport and your future?
That's a great question. As a track athlete, I feel like I have so many opportunities that I could receive from doing track, since I would consider myself talented and I work so hard to be in the position that I'm in. I could receive scholarships to go to college, I could receive medals and different, you know, opportunities. And I feel like if biological males continue to compete in track, they could take these away. They could take these away from me, and they could take these away from my teammates and other young girls who wish to pursue scholarships and different opportunities as well.
Yeah. And Mom, that's got to concern you a little bit, because, you know, the bird flies from the nest eventually, and you want her to be able to have a successful life of her own at some point.
Yeah, I want her to have that choice. And by the decisions that have been made lately with these policies, it's not giving our girls a choice.
Yeah.
It's basically taking away female sports. This is the end of female sports. And that's not trying to be dramatic. It's just what's happening. And we
I've been saying that for
experience.
I've been saying that for a couple of years, that there's not going to be any more female sports. There's going to be elite males and then co-ed, and then whatever
and
girls don't qualify for that.
I have compassion for everyone. I have compassion for all human beings. This is not what, you know, this is about having compassion. I see these athletes line up, and I see the criticism that happens at the track meets, the people shaking their heads, like saying, oh, they shouldn't be in that category. And what I'm saying is that I have compassion for them too, having to go through that experience, because they shouldn't have to go through that either. We can't have them in the same category. That's what the bottom line is.
Run the races according to sex, you know, and leave gender out of it. I think it's a simple solution. But the problem is, and you're seeing this a lot in modern culture, is that we avoid the simple solutions to be more appearing of being tolerant or understanding or something else. It's really not that tolerant. I mean, the best thing we can do is help everyone be the best person that they can be, and
exactly.
give them all the same opportunities to begin at the starting line together. Where they end up, that's kind of on their initiative and so forth, but at least give them the opportunities to do that. And that's all you're asking for, is that women be allowed to compete against women as they have for a long time, at least since Title IX went into effect. We didn't get to this part of your story, Cynthia. You actually won your race. You beat the man that was running against you.
Yes. So I always like to say comparably gifted and trained, because, again, for instance, in the state of Hawaii in 2019, there are about 700 boys that ran the 400 meters, and about 350 of them could beat the state champion female. So that means that literally a mediocre male can be the best female, you know, if they choose to identify. So there's a little bit of leeway there with talented and trained. And so while I just barely beat my opponent by a few tenths of a second, that person came back 6 months later and beat my teammate in a much shorter race for a spot on the podium, a medal, and prize money. So just because I won my, you know, race, basically, it doesn't mean that this is not an issue, and it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen in the future, or it doesn't mean that that individual can't train. And one thing that they usually say, like the athlete CC Telfer said, I haven't been strength training, I haven't been lifting weights because I don't want to appear too muscular. So what if this person does start lifting weights then and seriously trains? How much faster are they going to be? So it gets really complicated really fast.
Well, and speak to that for a second.
Speak
to that for a second.
You can't be in the same category.
Regarding the testosterone amount, just speak to that for a second. What's the allowable? And what and how does it appear normally?
Right. So the most elite female athletes are usually about maximum 3 nanomoles per deciliter is how they measure it. The Olympic Committee used to allow up to 10 nanomoles per deciliter, and now they allow 5, which is still way over the top ever female athlete. And most of these elite female athletes are still really under that 3. They're like 1.8 to 2 maximum.
Okay. Ladies, thank you so much for spending your Saturday night with us. We are very grateful.
Mahalo. We're really appreciative for you listening to our voice and allowing us to share our mission with others.
Well, we're gonna have you back when there's some development on your
whether it's a sunny staycation
order of fruits and veggies. Start your journey to better health today by calling 1-800-246-8751 or by going to balanceofnature.com. And make sure to receive this special radio offer by using discount code KMC.
All right, Kevin McCullough, glad to have you with us. Now, here is a look at that documentary that Cynthia and Margaret Monteleone were featured in.
I had the opportunity to compete at the World Championships in Malaga, Spain in 2018. I had put in so much hard work for this meet, as did my teammates for Team USA. When I got to the meet, I discovered that a biological male was in my race. Not only has this happened to me, but a year later, my daughter ran her first high school race against a biological male identifying as a female.
It was my first ever high school track meet my freshman year. I ended up taking second in my race next to this biological male, and I would have won my first ever high school track meet if it weren't for this athlete.
any athlete would do, I researched my competition before my meet in Spain. I found out that I was going to be competing against a biological male identifying as a female. When I saw the athlete, to my naked eye, I could see that they were definitely taller in stature and had seemingly larger bone mass. When I would ask questions, the team managers, they said, in fact, it would be safer for you to keep your mouth shut. Critics might say, what's the big deal? You won. But just because I won doesn't mean that this is not. A year and a half later, after my competition, my daughter lines up against this biological male in her race.
You could definitely tell they were physically stronger.
This athlete moved from the male volleyball team to the female volleyball team right before track season, and in fact injured one of the other girls in the league by a powerful spike.
I lost out on a chance to win my first ever meet, and it was very disappointing. We heard that they've only been training about 2 weeks beforehand, and I've been training the entire year. I did well, but I could have done so much better, and I could have won my first ever race.
As a coach and as a mother, seeing my daughter put in so many hours of hard work and being restrictive and in her eating, maybe passing on sweets and things like that to make sure that she was strong for her race, it was heartbreaking to see that she was running as fast as she could, and still this athlete breezed right by her. Not only that, but the girls I coach were having major anxiety. One girl was a senior. This was going to be her last season of track and field, and because of COVID, it turned out to be her last race. She actually broke down and started crying. And it wasn't that she was feeling any kind of negative thoughts towards this individual. It was that she knew that all of the hard work and training that she put in would be incomparable to the biological advantage of this powerful athlete. A lot of critics or a lot of people will say, this doesn't happen. This is a rare occasion. This is not really an issue. But what I'm here to say is that it is an issue. It's happening all the time. It's happening to myself, a mom, it's happening to my daughter, a high school athlete. This is not just something that is happening very rarely. I am there as a coach and as a mother. I am witnessing the psychological trauma to athletes like this girl, who then told me she didn't even want to run track for the rest of the season. What was the point, she said. I trained so hard for my event, and I have no chance of winning the conference championship.
I feel so sorry. Sorry for every girl that has gone through this, and I know so many people are, and I know what it feels like because I've had to go through this experience as well.
There are a lot of psychological studies that say when you believe you can win, you have a better chance of winning. It's the type of neurotransmitters that are firing, but how are these girls supposed to believe that when they're lining up against someone who has a biological advantage? Contrary to what people might think. Just because you take hormone therapy doesn't mean that you erase all of the biological advantages of being a male.
I hope to run track in college just as my mom did. It's always been my goal. I hope to maybe win state championships, and I know that if a biological male competes and becomes more powerful and more stronger and runs faster than me, then that opportunity may be taken away from me. A scholarship may go to someone else.
What will happen, especially in collegiate teams, is that a coach will now recruit and take scholarship opportunities away from a female athlete. Coaches at the collegiate level are rewarded for winning. And so these coaches will choose biological males in order to remain competitive in their conference. Where are the spaces for biological females then? What does this mean for equal opportunity for women?
To To those who may be doubting that this is really happening, it's happened to both me and my mom, and this is really happening to girls all across the country, all across the world, and opportunities are being taken away.
This pattern is dangerous. It's dangerous because it means the end of female sports.
I would say my favorite gold medal would be my World Championship gold medals to run Poland in 2019 indoor championships. And those mean a lot to me. However, they don't mean more to me than this issue. I would rather win this fight for fairness for all female athletes than to get another gold medal. This means more to me than that gold medal.
It's easy to place a label on someone, but to walk in their shoes is another story. Have they competed against someone who has a clear biological advantage? Have they trained hours and hours to have a chance for victory? They've told me to be quiet for my own safety, but I won't be quiet. I will continue.
84% of people have subscriptions.
Or when you call 800-506-2641. That's 800-506-2641. Promo code KMC. 800-506-2641. And use the promo code KMC. All right, ladies and gentlemen, live from New York, it's Radio Night Live, and here, once again, Riley Clemens.
You can knock on the door, but I'm not gonna let you in. You can play all your games, but I'm not gonna let you win again. You can step to me with all your negativity. Don't you know I'm just so over you under my skin? Now this time it's not even anger. I think we're just better as strangers. Don't try to laugh cause it changed though. You can't have my place, babe. Won't let you in my safe place. Nah, nah, oh, nah, nah, nah. You can say what you want, you can do what you like. You can throw another soul, but you're never gonna see my heart break. No, no, cause you can't find my face, face.
You can't have it.
For the first time, I ain't gonna give you a second thought. Cause your talk is so cheap that the pain isn't worth the cost. Oh, so do your worst to me, but you'll never get the best of me. Cause I know who I am, don't tell me what I'm not. Oh, oh, oh. Now I like the way I feel brand new. Matter of fact, I should thank you. I'm stronger for what you put me through. You can't stop my face, babe. Won't let you in my safe place. Nah, nah, oh, nah, nah, nah. You can say what you want, you can do what you like. You can throw another stone, but you're never gonna see my heart break. No.
The her brand newest, that was a little bit earlier in the evening, but Headspace from Riley Clemens, and glad to be able to wrap up this Radio Night Live edition with
Rick is really good at snoring.